Shalom Adoharnix. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We're in session number 7, dealing with the rise of Zionism. So let's take a quick review of where we were in our last session. Our last session, we explored the life of Leo Pinsker, who lived around 1882. He wrote Auto-Emancipation, which was quite well received in the Russian community, Russian Jewish community. We then explored the beginnings of the first Aliyah. Here's a picture of some of the pioneers of the first Aliyah, brave young people who came to settle the land. The Bilu organization was organized in Russia. Here's some of the Biluim, the forerunners of the kibbutz movement. Rishon LeZion was founded. They're close to the coast of Israel. Baron Rothschild began financing Jewish agricultural settlements in the land of Israel. Gedera was founded in 1884. William Blackstone, the first dean of the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, was active promoting Zionism and promoting biblical truth about the Jewish people and the return to the land at this time as well. The Katowice Conference met and felt that they needed to spend more finances on supporting Jewish agricultural settlements in the Holy Land. Dr. Nathan Birnbaum coined the term Zionism. And so I reiterated that by the time Theodor Herzl appeared on the scene in the 1800s, he encountered in Europe and in America the nucleus of a thoroughly respectable Zionist movement. The foundation had been laid. Its various societies provided him with the largest number of his followers, including 90% of the delegates attending the first Zionist Congress in 1897. Achad Ha'am, we explored his contribution to Zionism, Asher Ginsberg contribution. In 1890, Rehovot and Hadera were founded. In 1894, we came to a very important event, the Dreyfus Affair. Theodor Herzl was a reporter at the trial of Captain Alfred Dreyfus, an assimilated Jewish army officer who was accused of spying. He was found guilty. He was drummed out of the army, degraded, and sent to prison. And when the verdict was read, the French audience cried out, "Death to the Jews! Death to the Jews!" And that was Dreyfus's. That was Herzl's moment of recognition. He saw that assimilation was not a solution to anti-Semitism and the Jewish problem. He shared his vision of a Jewish state with Dr. Max Nordau, his closest collaborator and friend. All right, now we pick it up in 1896 when Herzl publishes Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State. Now, if there's more, if you'd like more information on the Judenstaat, here's a picture of the original publication. It's available also in English on Amazon.com, and if you're interested in it, you can pick it up on, you can read it on the Jewish Virtual Library as well. Now, in the title, Herzl was deliberately flinging the word Jew into the teeth of anti-Semites and those acculturated Western Jews who preferred euphemisms such as Hebrew or Israelite. Now, Herzl declared in his preface, "The idea which I have developed in this pamphlet is an ancient one. It is the restoration of the Jewish state. I shall do no more than suggest what cogs and wheels comprise the machinery I propose, trusting that better mechanics than myself will be found to carry the work out. The world needs the Jewish state. Therefore, it will arise." His main thesis in Der Judenstaat, "We are a people. One people. We have sincerely tried everywhere to merge with the national communities in which we live, seeking only to preserve the faith of our fathers. It has not permitted us." So only one solution remained. That was an exodus, a gathering together of the Jews from their worldwide dispersion into a land of their own. He said political principle will provide the basis, technology the means, and the driving force will be the Jewish tragedy. So as you can tell from these quotes, Herzl was a Europeanized, non-traditional, agnostic Jew. Where was God in his scheme of things? God didn't exist in his scheme of things. Now, Der Judenstaat was published in Vienna in February 14, 1896. English and French translations soon followed. Der Judenstaat introduced Zionism to European readers, to editors, university men, statesmen, other molders of public opinion, in the kind of language that they were accustomed to reading. And this is the contribution of the book. It communicated Zionism forcefully to Europeans. However, the initial reception of Der Judenstaat was less than favorable. Central European press, shocked by this aberration of one of their most distinguished members, ridiculed Herzl as a Jewish Jules Verne. And I hope you're familiar with Jules Verne. He was a writer, a fantasy writer around that time, science fiction and fantasy writer. He wrote The Time Machine, Journey to the Center of the Earth, From Earth to Moon, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So they're scorning Herzl, considering him writing a fantasy that could never come to pass. Even Rabbi Guterman, Herzl felt that Rabbi Guterman's loyalty was solid, but he even changed his mind. However, scorn and exasperation were no means the only reactions. Der Judenstaat was received warmly by Kadima, the Zionist Student Society of Vienna. David Wolfson, a leading Zionist in Cologne, Germany, was entirely overwhelmed by Der Judenstaat. He immediately traveled to Vienna to meet Herzl, and it was through Wolfson that, in turn, Herzl was introduced to the leaders of the German Chovev Zion. And through him, through Wolfson, Herzl learned of the writings of Leon Pinsker and Moses Hess, and of the tremendous Zionist renaissance in Eastern Europe. He became aware of it for the first time. It had been going on for quite a while, but finally Herzl becomes aware of it. Now, although the Tsar's censorship forbade publication of Der Judenstaat in Russia, Central European Jews began smuggling copies of the book into Russia, and soon Herzl's name and legend grew. Telegrams and letters of thanks poured into Herzl from Chovev Zion societies in Bulgaria, Galatia, Russia, and Palestine, calling upon the new Moses to accept leadership in the movement. 1897, the first Zionist Congress convenes. Herzl will be elected president in Basel. The notion of calling a General Zionist Day, which ultimately evolved into a Zionist Congress, was first suggested to Herzl. It wasn't Herzl's idea. It was suggested to Herzl in January of 1897 by Willy Bombas and Theodor Zlosisti, members of the German Kadima Society. Official invitations were published for the gathering, scheduled for August in Munich. But the Western Jewish response was one of outrage. The idea was denounced as treason, treason to Germany, treason to the fatherland, and a danger to Judaism. The site of the Congress was finally shifted to Basel, Switzerland. Now, here's a map of Europe, and here is Switzerland sitting in the middle of Europe, and now a close-up of the Swiss borders with Basel on the northern border of Switzerland. This is the Congress Hall. In 1897, when the Zionist Congress met there, and of course this is Basel today, a thriving Swiss city. Now, delegates from 15 countries, 204 representatives in all, were present. And here's a photograph of some of the major representatives. Here's another photograph of the representatives in the meeting hall as well, all the delegates. Now, during his presentation to the Congress, Herzl emphasized that older methods of piecemeal colonization in Palestine, deprived of international legal recognition, were no longer adequate. A new, permanent, and official body was required henceforth in order to cope with the Jewish question more directly and forcefully. The aim of Zionism would be a Jewish homeland openly recognized, legally secured. Now, for the achievement of the goal, the Congress approved four steps. And here's a copy of the original four-step plan. Number one, the encouragement of settlement in Palestine by Jewish agricultural workers, laborers, and artisans. Step two, the unification of all Jewry into local and general Zionist groups. Three, the strengthening of Jewish self-awareness and national consciousness. And four, diplomatic activity to secure the help of various governments. So the Congress established as its instrument a permanent Zionist organization. Herzl was unanimously elected president of the Zionist organization. The 3 days of discussion finally concluded with the singing of a Hebrew anthem, HaTikvah. You see, Herzl had anticipated the need for a national anthem and for a flag. And so both were present at the Zionist conference. Here is a transliteration into English of the words of HaTikvah. And here is a translation in English of the thoughts of HaTikvah. So if you're interested in both of those, you can keep that on your screen. And you can listen to HaTikvah at this address on YouTube. This is a very nice rendition of HaTikvah on YouTube. And then this is a sketch in Herzl's diary of the proposed flag for the Zionist movement. This was the original design, and it was simplified down to the design that we have today, the modern flag of the State of Israel. Now, in his diary, Herzl later wrote, "If I were to sum up the Basel Conference in a single phrase, which I would not dare make public," and you will understand why when I read it, "I would say," now if he's made this public, it would have caused a huge furor. "I would say, in Basel, I created the Jewish state." He has just ignored all the years and years of work and sacrifice that have gone on before he came on the scene. And secondly, he has usurped God's glory. Proverbs 16:9, "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps." Now, the first Zionist Congress gave powerful energy to Zionist propaganda throughout the world. Hundreds of societies were formed to augment the old Chovev Yitzion groups in affiliation with the Zionist organization, and membership in the organization climbed steadily. So Herzl has blasted off the launching pad, a launching pad that had been laid down carefully and very specifically by the God of the universe. In 1898, the Second Zionist Congress. In August of 1898, a Second Zionist Congress was convened, also in Basel, and this time the number of delegates had risen to 349, up 145 delegates, up from 204. And here is a picture of the Second Zionist Congress in session, and there is Herzl at the podium, speaking from the podium. Now, among the representatives, the new representatives, were those who would emerge subsequently as future giants in the movement. One of the new representatives is a man we'll encounter more and more in our study, Chaim Weizmann. At the Second Zionist Congress, detailed reports were given not merely on the circumstances of diaspora Jewry, but of Palestinian Jewry as well. Leo Motzkin, whom the Zionist organization earlier had sent to Palestine, now warned that under curtain legal restrictions, a mass migration to the Holy Land was impossible. And so on the other hand, in Herzl's view, infiltration, a piece-by-piece entrance into the Holy Land, was out of the question. It was the very opposite of his entire purpose. So a third choice was endorsed by the Congress. This was to simultaneously improve the unification of the Yishuv by colonization and industrialization. So that's kind of the piecemeal infiltrationist approach. But and at the same time, pursue all possible diplomatic efforts to acquire a charter for Jewish settlement of the Holy Land. And that's the mass migration approach. During the year of 1899, Herzl recognized that German influence was essential to convince the Ottoman Empire to look favorably on a Jewish charter. Eventually, he obtained an audience with Kaiser Wilhelm II, a rather arrogant man. Here is Kaiser Wilhelm in black and white in his finery, and here he is in color in all his finery. And finally, this is a modest, imperialistic, kingly drawing, painting of Kaiser Wilhelm II, a rather arrogant gentleman. Now, the Kaiser was first enthusiastic about the Zionist idea because he thought that it would free his country from politically radical Jews. However, when it was made clear that the Ottoman Sultan would not have anything to do with Zionism as an independent Jewish kingdom, the Kaiser dropped the Zionist cause and refused to receive its representatives. This was a bleak, bleak time for Herzl. Now we come to the Third Zionist Congress, August 1899. Herzl, and this was also held in Basel, Switzerland, Herzl explains his diplomatic efforts and he asks drafts of a charter to be written. The Jewish Colonial Trust Fund was founded, this a bank, and here's one of the notes for the Jewish Colonial Trust Fund, a share certificate. This organ would be responsible, would be a depository of funds that were raised for the Zionist organization. However, impatience with Herzl's failing diplomatic efforts was growing. 1900, the Fourth Zionist Congress. Not surprisingly, the Fourth Zionist Congress met in London in August of 1900 and was very confused and dispirited in its proceedings. And of course, London is in England, a map of England here, and here is London in the southeast corner of England. And London today, of course, we all know it as the thriving major metropolitan area of England. Now, at that same time, Herzl's employers were warning him about ignoring his journalistic responsibilities, and his personal fortune was rapidly being depleted by his Zionist expenditures. In January of 1901, he wrote in his diary, "The wind blows through the stubble. I feel my autumn approaching. I see before me the danger of leaving no achievement to the world or an inheritance to my children." In May 17th, his diplomatic efforts seemed to be bearing fruit. He was received by Sultan Abdul Hamid of the Ottoman Empire. Again, very modestly dressed there. The meeting, which received much publicity and enhanced the reputation of the Zionist organization, bore no practical results. During the Fifth Zionist Congress, assembled in Basel, December 26, 1901, all Herzl could do was speak of the highest hopes he entertained following the meeting with the Turkish ruler. There, the Jewish National Fund was established for land buying purposes, and the JNF still exists today. There is its modern logo and their JNF website if you're interested in going to the Jewish National Fund and learning about it. And if you plant a tree in Israel, you'll receive the certificate in appreciation from the JNF. Now, during the Fifth Zionist Congress, an important concern of Eastern Jewry reached a climax. The concept of the Easterners, led by Ahad Ha'am, was the obvious lack of Judaic spirit in the activities of secular Herzl and his closest collaborators. A group of 37 concerned delegates met and formed a party within the Zionist Congress. The party was not without influence, and it presented a resolution that Herzl accepted. The resolution affirmed that the education of the Jewish people in a national spirit is an essential part of the Zionist program. The resolution advocated the election of a cultural commission whose members included Ahad Ha'am. The group served essentially as a rallying point for those devoted to the goals of spiritual and cultural Zionism. 1902, Mizrahi was formed. As the Zionist organization grew, various parties were founded within the movement. This was a testimony to its strength. Various approaches and philosophies within the movement began taking political form. One of those emerging philosophies was religious Zionism. Religious Zionism now becomes a formal party within formal Zionism. You know, remember, religious Zionism was first conceived of by Judah Alkali. Religious Zionism was a conscious blending of Orthodoxy and Jewish nationalism. Religious Zionism played an important minority role in the Congress. Its inspiration was provided by Rabbi Samuel Molliver. And here's a picture of Rabbi Molliver. Rabbi Molliver was an early supporter of the Chovev Zion. He was willing to work side by side with avowed secularists like Herzl. His intention was working pragmatically with the secularists to induce his fellow Zionists into religious observance. So you see, he was kind of being evangelistic, proselytizing for rabbinic Judaism. He called his organization Merchatz Ruchani, spiritual center, or simply Mizrahi. And Mizrahi still exists today. Here's the website of the World Mizrahi Movement, Mizrahi.org, if you're at all interested in exploring the Mizrahi movement. It was not until the organizational efforts of Rabbi Isaac Jacob Renes, however, one of the authentic giants of Zionist history, that the Mizrahi became a conscious political movement within Zionism. And if you'll go to the World Mizrahi Movement webpage, you'll see a section on the history of Rabbi Renes. He's considered the founder of Mizrahi. Renes, too, was an early supporter of Chovev Etzion and then of Herzl's political Zionism. In 1902, he restructured the Mizrahi organization into a faction within the Zionist movement, both as a delegate to successive Zionist congresses and as an author on numerous books of religious philosophy. He preached a form of dual redemption, redemption of the land and redemption of the Jewish spirit. Neither could be accomplished, he argued, except within the precepts of what? Strict Orthodoxy, Rabbinic Judaism. So the contribution of Mizrahi lay in the fact that it made Zionism acceptable to traditional elements within Jewish life. Even with these accomplishments, Zionism was in the doldrums from 1901 to 1903. Very little progress was being made. It happened then in 1902 that the British Parliament appointed a royal commission to study the threat of cheap labor posed by the influx of Russian Jews to London's East End. Herzl was asked to appear before the parliamentary body on July 7, 1902, to describe the wretched conditions of East European Jewry and express hope that Britain would continue to offer asylum to the fugitives. Eventually, Herzl was interviewed by Joseph Chamberlain, a British colonial secretary. And here is British colonial secretary Joseph Chamberlain. He listened with interest when Herzl explained that Palestine was still the ultimate goal of Zionism, but the negotiations were dragging. Herzl outlined a plan to Chamberlain for temporary Jewish colonization of either Cyprus or Al-Arish on the northern Sinai Peninsula. Now, here's a map of the area. This is the land of Israel, of course. Now, Cyprus is to the north, an island to the north, so he proposed that this be a temporary home for the Jewish people, or, if not Cyprus, then the northern edge of the Sinai Peninsula at Al-Arish, that would be a temporary home for the Jewish people. Cyprus was ruled out immediately, but Chamberlain sent in motion negotiations regarding the Al-Arish site, and Herzl journeyed to Cairo. The Egyptian government rejected the idea because they disliked the notion of a Jewish enclave in their territory. Herzl now fell into black despair. Even this proposal was unrealized. It's simply done for, he wrote in his diary on May 11th. During this period of ebbing morale, he dashed off the novel Alt-Newland, Old Newland. This is a weak novel, but it ends with the famous line, "If you will it, it is no dream." So see, God is simply absent from Herzl's thinking. Proverbs 16:9, the heart of man plans his way. You can write Alt-Newland, but the Lord establishes his steps. But the Lord is the one who creates Alt-Newland. So you can read this book. You can get it on Amazon.com if you're interested in it. And again, you can go to the Jewish Virtual Library. East Africa proposal, the Uganda Project. In April 1903, Herzl returned from his ill-fated Cairo trip to report to British Colonial Secretary Chamberlain. Chamberlain unexpectedly dropped another proposal in Herzl's lap. He proposed that the territory for the Jews was British East Africa, erroneously but popularly known as Uganda. So here is Israel here to the north. Now, if we drop down the African continent all the way down to the middle of its eastern coast, we come into the approximate area of the British East Africa, the area of Uganda. Now, Herzl rejected this location at first. But as it developed, Herzl's commitment to the Holy Land or something nearby was shaken by events in Russia. The next month, in May a savage pogrom broke out in Kishinev. Kishinev, Russia, today known as Moldova. Here is the Moldova, the modern nation of Moldova, sandwiched between Romania and the Ukraine, right there. And here is Moldova again, and now Kishinev is located in the middle of the country. The persecution was so bad that Theodore Roosevelt criticized the Tsar for his treatment of the Jewish people, and this cartoon really highlights Theodore Roosevelt pointing out the Tsar's anti-Semitism. Well, Herzl, let me back up a little bit here. Let me leave the cartoon up. Herzl was shattered by the news of the atrocity. He notified Chamberlain that a Jewish commission of investigation would be sent to British East Africa. At the same time, he requested that a charter of Jewish autonomy be written. In Herzl's mind, East Africa was not intended to be a substitute for Palestine, but rather a training ground for it. We must have an answer to Kishinev, was his thinking. He felt the Jewish people needed an answer and needed it right away. Now, at this time, Pastor Blackstone sent Herzl a Bible, and he urged Herzl to reject the Uganda project. So, who knows how influential Pastor Blackstone was in all this. Well, now we come to the Sixth Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. The same mood of concern and urgency was shared by all factions within Zionism following the Kishinev pogrom. A mood of deep concern filled the Basel Assembly Hall on August 22, 1903, as the Sixth Zionist Congress got underway. Some kind of rescue effort had to be launched. East Africa was proposed as an asylum for the night. Reaction was divided and emotional. The resolution to dispatch an investigative commission was passed 295 to 177 with 100 abstentions. So the Sixth Zionist Congress was soon deeply polarized. To balance out the East Africa Investigative Commission, a Palestine commission was also appointed to study the circumstances in the Yishuv. The split soon extended far beyond the meeting hall of the Sixth Congress. Eliezer Ben-Yehuda wrote articles in defense of the East Africa proposal. Bitter debates and threats and impassioned protests followed, and throughout the Zionist world, family bonds and lifelong friendships were shattered over the issue. While the East Africa proposal created a crisis within Zionism, the availability of East Africa rapidly ended. English colonists strenuously opposed a mass influx of Russian Jews, and the idea faded into obscurity. Well, a 23-year-old delegate to the Sixth Zionist Congress was a young man named Vladimir Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky was reared in a secular Russian Jewish home. As a youth, he passed directly into Russian life, immersing himself in Russian literature and ideals, but Tsar's persecution soon shattered his love for Russia. Like Herzl and Nordau, he detected in the vision of a Jewish state an immediate and thrilling opportunity for national freedom and self-assertion. He was overwhelmed by Herzl at the Sixth Zionist Congress and became a fiery advocate of political Zionism. For Jabotinsky, as for Herzl, Zionism prefigured a revolution in character as well as in status. He regarded Zionism as the instrument by which Jews would shuck off their qualities of submissiveness and timidity and become instead bold, proud, and militant. Now, Jabotinsky traveled widely afterward, becoming a versatile linguist. In Italy, Jabotinsky developed his forceful oratorical style with an instinct for the theatrical. He generated an extraordinary personal magnetism. Ultimately, he would become the single most charismatic, the single most appealing figure after Herzl in Zionist history. And here's a little joke by Jabotinsky. You find it in Rabbi Joseph Talushkin's book, Jewish Humor. It's an ironic joke about anti-Semitism in Russia. Vladimir Jabotinsky says, "A Russian peasant once pronounced this mathematical theory, 4 and 4 make 8. With this we can agree. Some say that 5 and 3 also make 8, but that's a Jewish trick." So just an example of the anti-Semitic attitudes in Russia. Now we come to 1904 and the death of Theodore Herzl. The bitterness of the crisis took its toll on Herzl. Herzl's strength, physical strength, had already been undermined by his dedication to the Zionist cause. The East Africa struggle was the final assault on his health. A friend was startled by the change in Herzl at this time. He wrote of his experience. The imposing figure was now stooped, the face sallow, the eyes, those mirrors of a fine soul, were darkened, the mouth was drawn in pain and marked by passion. In the late spring of 1904, Herzl suffered a mild heart attack, and on June 3rd, he left for a resort to recuperate. However, on July 1st, a month later, 1904, his breathing became labored, he coughed up blood, and lapsed into a coma. On the afternoon of July 3rd, 1904, Herzl died at the age of 44, a young man. In his will, the Zionist leader had requested that his body be interred in Vienna, next to his father's grave, quote, to remain there until the Jewish people carry my remains to Palestine. The funeral took place in Vienna on July 7th. 6,000 people walked behind the cortege. Stephen Zweig recalled the huge procession was dignified until suddenly a tumult ensued at the cemetery. Too many had suddenly stormed to his coffin, crying, sobbing, screaming, in a wild explosion of despair. It was almost a riot, a fury. All order was overturned through a sort of elemental ecstatic mourning, such as I have never seen before or since at a funeral. And it was this gigantic outpouring of grief from the depths of millions of souls that caused me to realize for the first time how much passion and hope this lone and lonesome man had borne in the world through the power of a single idea. And here's a picture of the funeral procession as it headed for the burial in Vienna. On August 6, 1949, Herzl's remains were flown to Israel. The next day, they were interred on a ridge facing Jerusalem and bearing the name Mount Herzl. And here's a picture of the ceremony for the reburial of Herzl's remains on Mount Herzl. And if you go to Mount Herzl today, this is the site of Herzl's resting place, his final resting place. And of course, the Hebrew on that block of stone there reads Herzl. Now, you can learn about the life of Theodor Herzl if you want to study it in more detail from Mariah Films. There's a DVD, I think, on his life, Mariah Films. You can also watch this on Netflix as well. Learn more about Theodor Herzl. Now, let's do a little bit of an application. Some thoughts of application here. Theodor Herzl wrote, "In Basel, I created the Jewish state." In his ignorance and his arrogance, he was claiming glory. He was claiming credit that rightfully belonged to God alone. God would not allow Theodor Herzl to usurp his glory without consequences. The consequences were two in number. Number one, Herzl's tireless efforts to secure the Jewish state through a political action failed. He literally burned himself out, exhausted most of his fortune, and got absolutely nowhere in the political arena. Every political solution he pursued came to a dead end. He did not create the Jewish state. Secondly, the second consequence was premature death. There, that's a little better. The second consequence was premature death. He literally killed himself on behalf of the Jewish state. He was a workaholic. He was depending on his own efforts to secure success. Well, now, nobody, absolutely no one, expended more dedication and effort on behalf of the Jewish state. He only lasted 6 years, a scant 6 years after the first Zionist Congress, and he was dead from stress and effort, dead from heart problems. He did not create the Jewish state. He did not realize he was standing on the shoulders of all those whom God had used in all the previous years. He did not realize he was standing on a foundation that God had built. Instead, he took credit for himself. In Basel, I created the Jewish state. No, he didn't, Theodore. In Basel, God created the Jewish state. He just used you as his tool, his instrument. So let's not point our finger at Herzl and his mistake. Let's look at ourselves. Are we making the same mistake? Are we trying to go through life on our own steam, in our own power, without depending on God for guidance and for resources? Are we living life for our own glory and not living for the glory of God? If we do, we will end up just like Theodore Herzl. We will suffer the consequences of ignorance and arrogance. So let's learn from Theodore Herzl and always strive to live for the glory of God. Let's maintain a realistic view of ourselves. Yeshua said in John 15:5, apart from me, you can do nothing. We can do nothing of any eternal value on our own. Anything we do of any value in God's eyes is only because of his grace and his decision to use us as his tools. We are his servants and nothing more. As Pastor Blackstone stated, we are God's little errand boys. What we do accomplish in this life, we should humbly use to point to him and to glorify him. We should never forget to recognize all the people and resources that God brought into our lives that contributed to our accomplishment, whatever it happens to be. See, everybody stands on the shoulders of those who came before him. We should maintain a realistic view of ourselves and thank God for his grace and for his provision. All right, sermon's over. Let's move on to the material. 1904, beginning of the second Aliyah. At the turn of the century, two groups of Jewish settlers could be found in the land of Israel, the Old Yishuv and the New Yishuv. Both groups depended mainly on outside help for survival, the Old Yishuv on the Chalukah charity system and the New Yishuv on Rothschild or Zionist support. Jewish population totaled 50,000. Only 5,000 were to be found in the 20 rural colonies. The first Aliyah had been less than successful in producing a new Jewish farmer. Now, in 1903 came the Kishinev program, and Russian Jews began making their way to the Holy Land in 1904. Russia was in turmoil at that time. She was involved in the Russo-Japanese War. Taking advantage of the situation, the liberal element in Russia staged an uprising demanding social reform. Now, its hands tied by the war, the reactionary Russian government showed first a willingness to conciliate the revolutionary movement. But when the war ended, the government turned against the liberal elements and the revolutionary movement was crushed in 1905. The upheaval was suppressed in a nationwide chain reaction of pogroms. For the Jews, in fact, the intended political and economic oppression was the grimmest yet in modern experience. Their survival as a people now literally hung in the balance. Accordingly, a massive new Jewish immigration overseas started and gained momentum each year until the outbreak of World War I. In 1907, an appeal was issued from the Yeshuv, specifically by one Yosef Witkin. Witkin was a school teacher in a remote Galilee farm colony. Witkin insisted that departure for Palestine should neither be determined by mere doctrine or be inhibited by earlier failures in the Holy Land. What was required now was simple courage, a mighty effort of halutziut, a mighty effort of pioneering. It was an eloquent plea. The vision of becoming halutzim, pioneers, suddenly exerted a new and compelling attraction. For the majority of the 30,000 Jews who departed for the Holy Land in the Second Aliyah between 1904 and 1914, Witkin's pioneering challenge was the catalyst. The 10-year wave of immigration began another aspect of Zionism called labor Zionism. So this is a good time to review the streams of Zionism that are in Israel between 1904 and 1914. We begin with the type, the supporter, and the emphasis. So number one, we have political Zionism that was started by Herzl and his supporters. Secondly, we have religious Zionism promoted by Mizrahi. Religious Zionism stressed religious observance and orthodoxy. Third, there was spiritual cultural Zionism prompted by Ahad Ha'am and his followers. They focused on the cultural aspect of the Jewish people. And finally, we now have the newcomer to Israel, Labor Zionism. Labor Zionism stressed economics, socialism. They were socialists. The circumstances awaiting the newcomers in the land was bleak. Life was physically very, very harsh. In the largest village, Petah Tikva, The attitude of the established capitalist farmers was distinctly unfriendly and hostile to the socialist newcomers. Faced with this antagonism, the immigrants wandered from settlement to settlement in rags on the edge of collapse from malnutrition. David Ben-Gurion, a 19-year-old former student, was one of these immigrants. He succumbed to malaria, and he nearly died. Possibly 80% of the Second Aliyah returned to Europe and continued on to America within weeks or months after their arrival. Maybe 2,000, perhaps 2,000 hung on. So the onset of the Second Aliyah coincided with the growing momentum of Jewish agricultural settlement in Palestine. The number of new agricultural settlements was established by capable farmers. However, these settlements were more interested in creating productive villages than in fostering employment for the newcomers, the new immigrants. 1905, Seventh Zionist Congress rejects the Uganda Project. In 1905, the Seventh Zionist Congress met again in Basel, July 27th to August 2nd, 1905. A huge void existed in the Congress due to the death of Herzl. David Volson was elected to the presidency. The Congress likewise gave urgent attention to its future. In overwhelming numbers, the delegates rejected any colonizing activities outside of Palestine and voted for immigration and settlement in the land. The Congress also voted to actively encourage Jewish agriculture and industry in the Holy Land. Now, at this point, I would like to review all the other proposed locations for a homeland for the Jews, starting in 1652. Here are other Zions as proposed for the Jewish people. Dutch West Indies, 1652. Suriname in Dutch Guiana, 1654. The French West Indies, 1659. South America, 1730. Upper Mississippi and Missouri Rivers, 1819. Asia Minor, that's modern Turkey, in 1820. Niagara Falls, New York, 1825. Syria, 1839. Crimea in the modern Ukraine, 1841. Canada, 1884. Argentina, 1892. Cyprus, 1902. We read about that, or I've taught about that. Al-Arish, 1903. Uganda, we just looked at that, 1903. Brazil, 1904, Southern Mesopotamia, 1908 and 9, Syria, Nisha, in East Libya, 1908 and 1909, Australia, 1927, Birobidzhan, in East Russia, 1928, Madagascar, in 1940, and even Vietnam, in 1946. Now, good question is going to be asked. Michael Greenspan, in his DVD series, Against All Odds, Israel Survives, asks this question. He says, 22 national homes for the Jewish people have been proposed from 1652 to 1946. Why did all these proposals fail except for Israel, the historic homeland of the Jewish people? And of course, there's the answer. Because God has given us a homeland. He's given us the title deed to the land of Israel. That is our historical homeland. That is where He will return us, and no other place. The Bible only speaks of returning to the land of Israel. Good question asked by Michael Greenspan. All right. Pogroms continue in Russia and Poland. Mass immigration continues. 1906, Hebrew High School established in Jaffa. And in 1906, a 19-year-old Polish immigrant named David Green arrived in Jaffa Harbor. He would change his name and subsequently would become the single Jewish person most fully identified with the Yeshuv. The name that this young Jewish Polish man adopted was the name David Ben-Gurion. Every facet of his life reflected a stage in the history of Zionism. In the years before 1914, he labored as a farmhand in the citrus groves. During World War I, he served in the Jewish Legion. Here is a picture of David Ben-Gurion in uniform. After the war, he became a leader of the political party Achdut HaAvodah. He would become Secretary General of the Histadrut. In 1935, he was elected chairman of the Palestine Executive of the Jewish Agency and would therefore find himself thrown headlong into the world of statesmanship. Ben-Gurion was no suave diplomat like Herzl. He was the extreme opposite. In heart, he remained a tough Union leader, forceful and outspoken and stubborn. He looked like the militant role he was to play, short, stocky, hands calloused, face hard and weather-beaten, and his chin thrusting belligerently forward. And this portrait epitomizes that description of David Ben-Gurion and shows how opposite he was of Theodore Herzl. There is suave, debonair Theodore Herzl. Here is down-to-earth, plain Jane, tough, outspoken David Ben-Gurion. Two very, very different men. His colleagues remembered a single-minded devotion to the cause of the Jewish national home that approached fanaticism, a total disinterest in material comforts, and a lack of personal vanity that was not to be confused with indifference to authority. Ben-Gurion was determined to ensure his nation's security against all opposition and against all odds. And again, from Rabbi Telushkin's book, Jewish Humor, I ran across this joke about David Ben-Gurion, which I enjoyed, so I hope you will enjoy it. It's an American Jewish, presumably apocryphal story. We don't know if this is real or not, but it's clever. When President Dwight Eisenhower met with Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, the American president said at one point, "It's very hard to be the president of 170 million people." Ben-Gurion responded, "It's harder. It's harder to be the prime minister of 2 million prime ministers." That's the way Israeli politics go, doesn't it? 1907, the eighth Zionist Congress in The Hague, Netherlands. We move on to 1909, Degania founded. In 1903, the Zionist organization established in Jaffa a subsidiary of the Jewish Colonial Trust Bank, known initially as the Anglo-Palestine Company, later as the Anglo-Palestine Bank. It granted loans at low interest to merchants and manufacturers, to farmers and building societies. Later, in 1908, the Zionist organization opened the first Palestine office in Jaffa. And from these headquarters, it was anticipated that the Jewish National Fund properties would be administered and additional land purchases negotiated. The office's first director was 32-year-old German Jew, Dr. Arthur Rupin. Rupin fostered the idea of one of the Yeshu's most noteworthy social innovations, the kibbutzah, the collective settlement. The term kibbutzah refers to small collective settlements, and the word kibbutz refers to the larger collective settlements. But kibbutzah and kibbutz are now known today under the embracing generic term of kibbutz. So whether they're smaller or large, a collective community is a kibbutz today. Now, the very first one was established at the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. In 1909, on behalf of the Jewish National Fund, Arthur Rupin acquired a 300-acre stretch of uncultivated land, Yuni, on the shores of Lake Galilee. Shortly afterward, he funded a group of immigrants who proceeded to work the tract along conventional lines. They failed. A year later, in 1910, 36 members of a young labor Zionist group asked permission to farm Yuni on a collective basis. Rupin approved. This time he provided the farmers with a rather larger patch of land adjacent to Yuni, complete with mud brick dormitories and some basic farm equipment and half a dozen mules. The experiment was a grim ordeal. The Jordan Valley was an inferno, and malaria took a heavy toll of the little group. Nevertheless, discipline and organization saw the farmers through, and the farm brought in a decent harvest in 1911, and so its members purchased additional livestock. By then, they had given the little kibbutzah the name Degania, cornflower. And you can see on the left-hand map, we're focusing on the northern Israel, near the Sea of Galilee, and on the right-hand map there at the very tip, the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee, is little Degania, cornflower. That's the flower that it is named after, the cornflower. This is the first hut that was erected at Degania, and then this is Degania today, a flourishing kibbutz. Now, Dagonya's fame spread rapidly. Shmuel Dayan, the father of Moshe, joined Dagonya the following year, 1912. And then Moshe Dayan would be born there in 1915. Inspired by the success of Dagonya, other groups moved into Jewish National Fund land and started collective farms of their own. The collective was to become Zionism's most innovative and influential experience in human relations. HaShomer. In September of 1907, 10 young men gathered in the attic of Yitzhak Ben Zvi's rooming house in Jaffa. Here's Yitzhak Ben Zvi. Addressing the group, Israel Shochat, here's Israel Shochat, reminded it that the conquest of labor also necessarily embraced the Jewish right to self-defense. For several months, Israel Shochat had been traveling through the yeshuv, entreating his fellow agricultural workers to assume responsibility for guarding the land that they were plowing. It was unthinkable, he insisted, to maintain a practice of hiring Arab or Circassian guards to protect Jewish property and lives. This was no way to start a nation. Or maybe it'd be better to say this is no way to revive a nation. The future of the Jewish nation was at stake, Shochat warned. If the Jews were capable of farming their land, should they not be capable of defending it? And now, finally, in September of 1907, a program was drafted to form a secret society of Jewish watchmen. It was called Bar Giora, after the celebrated Jewish warrior of antiquity. Here's a bust of Bar Giora, Shimon Bar Giora. He was the leader of the first Jewish revolt, 67 through 70. The founding members pledged themselves to accept employment as guards whenever the opportunities arose. They resolved as well to speak only Hebrew and to live together whenever possible on a collective basis. It was the Bar Giora members who pioneered the kibbutzah at Sejera. It was at Sejera, too, that the would-be Jewish guards requested jobs as watchmen from the manager of the neighboring farm school. When the man proved skeptical, the young activists proceeded to steal a mule from under the nose of the hired Circassian and return it the following morning. And the director was convinced. From then on, the farm remained under Jewish protection. The little Bar Giora group subsequently offered itself out to the other neighboring villages as guards, as watchmen. Soon the Jewish village of Meshka ventured to dismiss its Moroccan watchmen and hire two of the Bar Giora group. With two villages won over by 1909, Shochat and his friends recognized that a small clandestine society no longer was adequate. Additional watchmen were needed to offer protection throughout the yeshuv. To achieve that goal, Bar Giora was reincarnated under a new title, HaShomer, the Watchman. Its new charter defined the guild's purpose as the formation of a society of Jewish guards. Requirements for admission were so inflexible that after 2 years, the original group of eight was increased only to 26. And there is a picture of the early HaShomer group. I think I've got 23 members is pictured in this photograph. The training program was exceptionally rigorous for these new candidates. Candidates were drilled in night maneuvers, scouting, direction finding, conversational Arabic. Those few who were accepted into the society were known as exceptional horsemen and crack shots. Mounted, brawny, armed, confident in bearing, they evoked respect among the Arabs. Soon all Lower Galilee came into HaShomer's fold, the settlements of Yavneel, Beit Gan, Nenachamia, Sarona, Mitzpah, Kinneret. By 1911, the guild had acquired a foothold in Samaria to the south. From there, its fame spread to Judea, then to the coastal plain, where the large capitalist plantations invited HaShomer to take charge of the watch. Few settlers ever regretted their choice of protection. Despite repeated Bedouin attacks, the Shomerim kept security tight. Other villages subsequently were added to their clientele, Rishon LeZion, Ben Shemen, Be'er Yaakov. By 1914, the Watchman's Guild operated four squads in Judea alone, and they boasted 100 men throughout the Jewish Palestine, all on instant call whenever danger threatened. By the eve of World War I, HaShomer's legend of valor had dramatically raised the morale of the yeshuv. 1909, Tel Aviv is founded. In 1909, from Jaffa, a new suburb emerged that was destined ultimately to become the metropolitan center of Jewish life in Israel. And that is the city of Tel Aviv on the coast. Now, Jaffa's population numbered only 6,000. Jewish population numbered only 6,000 at that time. Jaffa was a port city. It was squalid. It was largely Arab. Dr. Rupin was intrigued by the notion of building an all-Jewish satellite community. With the endorsement of the 8th Zionist Congress, he agreed to lend JNF funds to a private development company, the Ahuzat Bayit, the Homestead Society. They, in turn, sold individual plots in both Europe and the issue for future Jewish settlement. In 1909, construction began on sand dunes outside the Jaffa town limits. Now, here is the picture of the founding of Tel Aviv. These people are gathered, and they're drawing lots to claim their plot of land. By 1904, the modest community had grown up, encompassing 139 houses and 1,419 Jewish inhabitants. The community was named Tel Aviv, Hill of Spring. And the population reached 16,000 by 1924 and continued to explode. 5 years later, in 1929, the population was 46,000 Jewish people. And by 1939, the population had grown to 139,000 Jewish people. And here is early Tel Aviv, sometime close to 1939, as it has grown up. Today, the population of the city itself is 410,000, and the population of the metro area is 3,405,000. Modern Tel Aviv. And this is modern Tel Aviv in the Shalom Tower. I show this because the very first time I was ever in Tel Aviv, I believe it was 1995, 1996, right around there, the Shalom Tower was the only skyscraper. It stood out like a sore thumb. So we went up the Shalom Tower sightseeing. We get a beautiful view of Tel Aviv, an unobstructed view of Tel Aviv. It was the only skyscraper. Look at it now. And here is modern Tel Aviv and the Shalom Tower. Can you find the Shalom Tower in this picture? Yeah, there it is. Just one of many, many skyscrapers. And here to the south is Jaffa. All right. 1911, the 10th Zionist Congress. This was in Basel, Switzerland. In 1911, this Congress was convened. At this meeting, the Congress approved extensive land purchasing activities by the Palestine office in Jaffa, headed by Arthur Rupin. Furthermore, the Congress resolved that Hebrew, from then on, would be recognized as the official language of the Zionist movement. And as a result, teaching in Hebrew intensified in the diaspora, and that would be much to Eliezer Ben Yehuda's delight. All right, I see we just have a minute or so left, and so let's call it quits right here. We'll pick it up next session in 1914 with the beginning of World War I, and we'll see its effect upon emerging state of Israel and the Zionist movement. All right, we'll see you next session in 1914 with World War I. We're so glad that you've been our students through this session. We'll be glad to see you next time. Lehitraot.